another year and another State of the Union.
What a difference a president makes. A short time ago, we were a dead country. Now we are the hottest country anywhere in the world, the hottest. The state of our union is strong. Our country is winning again. In fact, we're winning so much that we really don't know what to do about it. People are asking me, please, 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 Mr. President, we're winning too much. We can't take it anymore. We're not used to winning in our country. Until you came along, we're just always losing, but now we're winning too much.
Bruce Shapiro, I hope that there, in your snowbound little town, you rose to applaud the President of the United States as he made each of those golden claims.
Well, look, this speech was kind of a desperate throw for President Trump, this year's State of the Union. It's really important to recognize that he gave it at a moment when his poll numbers have been plummeting among independent voters who were crucial to his victory, but Latino voters who were crucial to his victory, young voters who were crucial to his victory. And when Republicans around the country are really getting very anxious about their chances in the fall, this was a kind of a strange speech, I think, even by President Trump's standards, you know, and we can run through a few things, but you know, overall, it went, first of all, it went on and on.
And on.
And on. It took what has become a kind of trope of State of the Union speeches since the Reagan era, the kind of recognizing people in the gallery and so on, and turned it into a kind of royal medal-laying ceremony, the King's Holiday Honors, where one military member after another, one law enforcement officer after another, one, even the U.S. hockey team were all festooned with pieces of metal from the President of the United States. You know, at the same time, in content, a couple of things stood out at me, given the stakes for this president. One was that, you know, even by President Trump standards, I think it's safe to say that this particular speech broke the bullshit detector, the level of counterfactuality around the economy, around immigration, around crime, around lots of different subjects was very high. But also for a president who, as in that grab you played at the top, was trying to say that America is back, America is great, it actually was filled with blood and fear and terror in order to try to rouse an increasingly dubious and sour electorate. The speech was threaded through, the most consistent thread were portrayals of violence against American citizens. We heard about shootings and stabbings. I took a list here: slashing, shooting, kidnapping, hit and run, shot in the head, blood all over the aisle, gushing blood, one thing after another. It was as if President Trump was turning to kind of the language of true crime and tabloid headlines as the only way to hold people's attention over the span of 90 minutes. The kind of theme of American carnage that was metaphorical in his first term became literally the core content of this speech, I think, in an attempt to distract from the violence. His own Department of Homeland Security, his own ICE, inflicted on Americans in Minneapolis and has inflicted on immigrants, on migrants all over the country, an attempt to distract from an affordability crisis, which really is shaking up the country's politics. And at the same time, it was by far the most combative speech we've seen, a State of the Union speech we've seen, repeatedly deriding Democrats. These people are crazy. The small number of Democrats in the hall creating a kind of spectacle, their own spectacle of refusing to applaud, and him trying to challenge that with one issue after another that people were supposed to applaud on. It was, in its own way, an extraordinary spectacle, even finally, though it was a numbing one.
And the ritual of it is so fascinating. I mean, not just applause, but the standing ovation. And there behind him as he speaks are the speaker and the vice president. And you can sort of see them looking at each other to think, you know, do we have to stand again? And yes, well, they stood again.
Well, and this of course, has become, in the television age, the again, the visual tropes of State of the Union. And to be fair to a president who is fair to very few people himself, Donald Trump did not invent that part of the spectacle. You know, once upon a time, the State of the Union message, which goes back to George Washington, was conceived as a sober report to the Congress on exactly what it says, the State of the Union, the tradition of saying the State of our Union is strong and all of that. It has really, over a couple of generations now, devolved into this kind of a spectacle where a president of one party makes their points, proposes their policies, their people stand up and applaud. Maybe people can find some excuses to stand up and applaud for the office or to stand up and applaud for something everyone can agree with. You know, you saw the Democrats stand up for the World War II and Korea veterans, the 100-year-old veterans who received medals, right? So
but
Trump,
Bruce,
was trying to choreograph that, right?
What were they doing there? There is a fine warrior. You can tell a fine warrior because he's 100 years old and his left breast is covered with medals. There are about 25 ranks of medals on his left breast. He fought heroically in a dogfight in the Korean War in 1952, and there he is being given another medal. And this by a man who declined military service himself.
And again, to be fair to this president, he is not the first non-service member, and even not the first Vietnam service avoider to hand out medals. I think what will be quite interesting will be to learn who turned down the invitation to be part of Trump's spectacle. We already know, for instance, that the U.S. Olympic women's hockey team politely declined to be part of tonight's spectacle. Whereas the men, and it needs to be said, in all of sports, the whitest team you could possibly find in American sports.
Oh, Bruce, fair enough. I mean, it's a snow sport. I mean, gone.
Right. Did agree to be part of this spectacle and were cheered and got medals, and Trump got to have some fun in the middle of a speech that was, you know, supposed to be serious. But we are at a point where the State of the Union has become not only an empty spectacle, but now a fully, comprehensively partisan campaign event. That's all it was. It certainly didn't, I don't think it advanced President Trump's political fortunes in any substantial way. This was a speech to his base, but his base is not his problem. His base are voters who swung back and forth, weren't sure what to do, did not like Joe Biden, voted for Donald Trump, and now are dealing with rising costs, are dealing with deep unhappiness at the real violence visited on Americans in the heartland. I spent several days last week in Minneapolis speaking to journalists and others there. The middle of the country, the Midwest, deeply connected to farmland, a part of the country where people are just outraged at the massive invasion by Immigration and Customs Enforcement and the violence visited on American citizens and on neighborhoods. This has caused disquiet all over the country, and nothing in the speech tonight suggested that President Trump is ready to suggest that. If I were a Republican or a Republican political analyst right now, my worries would only be deeper. I don't think the president did himself any favors.
The lies, the parade of lies in the speech, being fact-checked in real time by the New York Times and others. And Trump stood there and said, "We will always protect Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid." And yet, has he not cut about $1 trillion out of Medicaid?
Well, yes. I think he probably threw it in because he forgot the difference between Medicare and Medicaid. Medicaid, of course, is health care for the poor. He has shredded that all over the country, left more and more of it to states. He's played the game of trying to divide health care to the poor from health care to the elderly, right? And that is causing an enormous burden, a disproportionate burden, actually, on red states, which are among the poorest states in the country. But look, the lies began and the deception began almost in the first line of the speech when he said very early on, under our administration, zero illegal aliens have been admitted to the United States. Well, of course, the nature of illegal immigration is that illegal migrants are not admitted. They simply come in. You know, the fog started emanating fog from the very beginning of the speech, and that only accelerated when talking about unemployment figures, the economy, and so on. And again, I think what President Trump failed to respond to was a growing weariness in large parts of the American public with this kind of politics.
I found the applause fascinating and sometimes, frankly, Bruce, cruel. When he was praising his wife, Melania, as a film star, there was hardly a scattering of applause. There was massive applause for the 100-year-old veteran of Korea. But I don't know about you, but I thought the loudest, most prolonged, most enthusiastic applause was for his long riff condemning illegal aliens, that was the issue that most struck a chord in that room.
We are deporting illegal alien criminals, country at record numbers, and we're getting them the hell out of here fast. We don't want them.
Well, that remains the issue on which, immigration remains the issue on which the Republican Party thinks they stand the best chance of stirring up their base and regaining some support. And indeed, part of the alarm in Republican quarters at the deaths of Renee Good and Alex Preddy in Minneapolis was the fear that the invasion of Minneapolis, the invasion of Chicago by ICE were squandering immigration, were squandering political gains and substantive gains in shutting down and diminishing border crossing, right? So, the Republicans still love immigration as an issue. They don't love ICE, and they don't love what has happened over the last several weeks. The interesting thing about the applause is that it's always a bit of a spectacle and a game, usually a somewhat good-humored game. Here, Democrats made the decision, first of all, many of them made the decision simply to boycott the speech. Democrats had their own counter event outside the Capitol. The numbers were small. Those Democrats who did attend, including some quite progressive members of Congress, who, like Senator Elizabeth Warren, who said she felt she needed to be there for the people of Massachusetts, they sat on their hands in a quite disciplined way. And indeed, between the empty seats and the lack of applause, when the camera would pan over Congress, I thought that most of the time it did make the Republicans who were standing up and applauding look like a minority faction. I thought on the whole, while President Trump tried to turn it around by coming up with issues that Democrats would be embarrassed, presumably, not to stand up on, I thought that the spectacle on the whole made it look like the Republican Party was a loud but diminished faction rather than expanding into a consensus of American opinion.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr. I'm talking to our man in America, Bruce Shapiro. Bruce, who did you think was the saddest figure that Trump asked to stand in the gallery? My vote goes to that young woman who decided not to transition.
There were several children who were called out by Trump. There was the young woman who had decided, for whatever reasons and under whatever pressures, not to transition under what were clearly very difficult circumstances. There were other young children who were kind of put front and center, and those are all heartbreaking, as are the parents of murdered adult children who were called out.
Yes.
And again, this was part of this, for all the championing of America is back and we're here and it's great, this undercurrent of violence and social distrust and social disruption, which was the real theme of the speech, one victimization after another, right, was really the story of this speech. And on the one hand, you could say, well, it's, you know, smart politics. On the other hand, you could say President Trump did not really have a whole lot else to hold public attention with. And so he turned back to, you know, that thing that television producers know very well, which is that you can always put another police reality show, another blue light show. There's always an audience for, and in a way, he was trying to turn the State of the Union into that.
There's a thing that Trump keeps saying, and I wonder what you think of this. Can you believe it, he says. Who would believe that, he says. People don't believe it, he says. It's hard to believe. They can't believe it.
Nobody can believe what they're watching.
And what is this theme of his that he keeps coming back and back to, that things are hard to believe?
Well, if I were, let's say, a Freudian psychohistorian,
which you are,
I might say that the president was, in a very uncorked way, telling you how to read his own speech. This is hard to believe. Can you believe it? No, you can't. Interestingly, right before turning on the speech tonight, I was flipping around the dial and noticed that Turner Classic Movies had, some genius at Turner Classic Movies had programmed opposite the State of the Union, Gaslight. Gaslight. And, I think it's safe to say that just as when the president in this speech was calling out corruption in politics and telling members of Congress that they shouldn't do stock trades, and Representative Ilhan Omar or someone else, some of the Democrats shouted out from the floor, what about you? The president was really describing himself when he's talking about corruption and self-dealing. This is a family profiteering business and a cabinet profiteering business and an allies profiteering business. And he's, it's crony capitalism at its most blatant. And he also, when he says, can you believe it? He's giving you a roadmap to his own words.
Now, Bruce, how badly damaged has Trump been by the Supreme Court's decision on tariffs?
This was basically at the heart of this speech, and again, part of the motivation for this distracting spectacle, was the Supreme Court decision on Friday ruling his signature economic plank to be unconstitutional. This is not only undermining all the tariff deals he made around the world, not only sort of slapping him down on his ability to impose tariffs, it was a warning shot, a 6-3 warning shot, that even a Supreme Court dominated by conservatives is not going to settle for unbridled executive power. And President Trump damaged himself not only with the claiming emergency powers to impose tariffs that didn't exist, but then in his reaction to the Supreme Court, essentially calling them lapdogs of foreign powers, insulting the very court that still needs to hear his.
It's inconceivable that you would antagonize the justices in that way.
You always see the justices being stone-faced. Interestingly, only 4 of the 7 even showed up to the State of the Union. They've been showing up in diminishing numbers, but this was pretty dramatic. He went out of his way in the speech to use the word unfortunate rather than some of the more pointed language of the other day. But there's no doubt that the president has been gravely wounded. He claimed in the speech that he has other authorities to issue tariffs, but in fact, they require congressional approval. They are limited to 150 days or 160 days, less than 6 months. There's all kinds of limits on the tariffs that he can impose. And now countries that made tariff deals with him are learning the lesson that universities that made illegal deals with Trump and others have learned, which is that the deal you make in the short run may not turn out well for you when the courts rule it to be unconstitutional. So there is quite a mess.
Bruce, thanks once again for joining us on Late Night Live.
As always.
I have been talking to Bruce Shapiro, our snowbound man in North America.